Thanks, Jason. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. I've been asked by several people, where is Kassel? So here it is, right in the center of Germany. Frankfurt is here, Munich somewhere there. This is Berlin. And even though you may not have heard of it before, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site because of this guy. So that's Hercules, dating back to the 17th century. And actually, it was financed by selling subjects of the province to the British to fight here in the US in the War of Independence. So things seem to be connected. This is not, if you would come visit, this is not how you would see him. You would rather see him more like this in the park. And there's one more reason for which Kassel is known, and that is Documenta, which is a contemporary art show, held every 5 years. So the next one is coming up next year. In case you're around, make sure to stop by and visit. And Kassel also does have physics, so let me come to that. And since I'm more or less the only real control people, a person here, maybe not the only control freak, but the only person who does control for, let's say, for a living, I'll try to make this a broad overview talk. So I have quite a big program to go through, and I'll try to really cover most of it, but you'll feel free to stop me anytime you want. I'll be happy to talk about any of the details in more detail later in person. So what is control? Well, generally, it's simply the concept of steering a dynamical system from an initial state to a final state with some external knob. And one of the most famous real-life examples is the Apollo mission, where the landing of the spaceship on the moon was done using optimal control theory. So in that case, what was our dynamical system? Well, it was governed by Newton's equations of motion. And the control knob was to change the acceleration by burning fuel. And the target was to land the spaceship smoothly on the surface. And this was done with optimal control, which is a theory that allows you to do this with a certain accuracy with minimal expenditure of effort. So for example, minimum energy, minimum time. And it's a general mathematical toolbox. So you may ask, what is quantum about it? Well, quantum is when we apply it to quantum systems, because then we have quantum dynamics, and there are the two hallmarks that come in. One is the superposition principle, as you all know it. And the key here is that if we superimpose quantum states, we have a relative phase with which we can do this. So this plus or minus is just one specific instance of a relative phase. And the idea of quantum control is to use these interferences to steer your dynamics in a certain desired way. And of course, the second hallmark is entanglement. So we can both use interference, matter wave interference, and entanglement to realize the desired control. And we don't use fuel in this case, but we use external fields, such as electric fields, magnetic fields, to steer the dynamics. So classical fields. That's the basic idea. So if we put this into a more mathematical framework, what we have to do is we have to say, what is our objective? What is our goal? And the simplest example is we have some initial state that after a certain time t, we want to perfectly match a given target state. And now what we do is we simply treat this as a functional of our external control. Absolutely. And then we can add additional constraints, because typically in physics you have finite amplitude, finite time in any case, and so on. So you can add these in your target functional. And then you use what you all know from your probably undergraduate physics, the variational principle. So what you have to make sure is that you have an optimum both with respect to your external control, but since the state of the system also depends on the control, also with respect to the state dynamics. And then typically we assume that we can write the Hamiltonian of the system in this form, that we have a drift term that is independent of the external field and a control term or several control terms. And then if you carry out this condition and evaluate it, what you end up with is a set of equations which is coupled that tells you how do we have to change your control in order to better achieve this target.
Now, what's crucial is the choice of H1, right?
H1 is given to you by the physics of the system. So H1 could be an electric dipole moment or magnetic dipole moment, depending on what your control is. And now what you're asking is, how do we have to modify the shape of your control to achieve this goal? And for very simple systems, like two-level systems, three-level systems, you can do this analytically, because this is nothing but a different way of formulating Pontryagin's principle. But in general, you cannot solve the equations analytically, and then you have to resort to numerics. And then the tricky part is that when you evaluate these conditions, you get a set of coupled nonlinear equations. And there are different tricks how to discretize them such that you have, let's say, benign numerical algorithm. And everybody has its own little version, so we have ours, and other people have developed other algorithms. But in the end, this is what you have to do. You have to solve this equation, which means that you are propagating forward your initial state from time zero, initial state to time t, and you're propagating backwards your target state. And then at time little t, you're matching the two with this control Hamiltonian, and that tells you how to modify your control field.
I missed a little bit. What's the variation respect to phi of t? I mean, I thought that's just, so why is phi of t, you know, you have initial state and you have a target state.
Because your functional depends on epsilon both directly and also indirectly through phi. So a way to evaluate the gradient of j with respect to epsilon is to evaluate these two partial derivatives. So in the end, this equation is nothing, but it tells you how to evaluate the gradient of your optimization function.
But is your initial state also variational parameter?
No.
No, okay.
But so this is just the simplest example where you say, I know I have a certain initial state, and I want to go to a certain final state. And I tell you how to go to more general control problems in just a minute.
Sorry. Why is phi not simply a function of epsilon? Once you fix epsilon of t.
Yes, but you don't know epsilon.
Okay. Do you also want to minimize the total time
with t? So that's, for us, it's always a parameter. In the end, we do want to minimize it, but we have to do it in a self-consistent way. We cannot include it directly here as a parameter. And I'll discuss examples for that also later.
Are there other constraints we can put on the epsilon? I mean, for example, as an experimentalist, you know, usually what comes out in the optimal control is some crazy pulse form. Mm-hmm. So when I see that, I say, oh my god, you know, I have to do like that. So I would like more benign, can we include these constraints?
Yes, you can. So that is actually one of the reasons why I like our version of the algorithm best, is because it tells you what are the conditions, the most general conditions that you can have on your constraints. And the point is, you have to be able to formulate this as a positive or semi-definite form. So we can even put spectral constraints, something that for a long time was believed not to be possible, if we formulate it in an appropriate way.
I guess more generically, you may have a number of epsilons
exactly.
By different mm-hmm. non-commuting Hamiltonians.
Yes, and I'll come to that also.
So this is mostly for systems with a small number of degrees of freedom.
Yes, so it's not my... So Tommaso Colacco uses it also for many body examples, but the focus of my group is really on few body.
So because I guess if you try to apply it to a many body system, then looking at the overlap is not a good measure, right? So you should look at local...
Okay, so that is something I will come to. So the point is... this is just a basic example of as a starting point, but you can formulate very different functionals, and the point is always that you have, this is the job. I mean, the rest is just an algorithm, right? You turn on your computer and you wait, but your time to think should go in how to construct this functional, and it should reflect the physics of what you want. And I'll give some examples. If you want local observables, you can optimize local observables, or minimize, whatever. The point why it's not something that you can easily do with many-body systems is that no matter which optimization variant you're using, you always need to propagate many times. So you need to have a system where you can, let's say, a few hundreds of times at least. So if you can afford this, if this is still within a feasible computation time, then you can do optimization calculations. If not, then no. Okay, so here comes already the next question. So what kind of targets can we look at? Because the state-to-state transition was just the first example. So one of the first things when people from control started to think about quantum computation that they came up with was to say, well, you can realize a certain unitary or a quantum gate. And then all that you have to do is you have to lift. I mean, here you have essentially a scalar product between your propagated state, so your actual state, and your target state. And now if you want to optimize for a gate, you have to optimize the overlap, the Hilbert-Schmidt product of your desired operation, which I called O here, and your actual evolution. And one of the reasons to use optimal control is that in real world, you don't usually have qubits, but you have larger Hilbert spaces. So your actual evolution may happen in a larger Hilbert space, you have to project down to the logical subspace. Okay, that's why you have these projectors. And then if you again go through this birational calculus, you end up with an equation which looks very similar to the one on the previous slide, just that now you have here the sum over states, and these states are simply a basis of your logical subspace. Okay, so instead of solving this equation for one state, you have to do it for two states for a qubit, or four states for two qubits, and so on.
So I missed, what is all?
Let's say you want
GT change. Why does it not have the
operator? So I said I'm not interested in one specific state to one specific target state, but I want to optimize. I want to implement a unitary operation, a gate, a quantum gate. Let's say a C naught. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I call this gate. I call it O.
So it's an array of qubits.
It would act on one or two or however many qubits you have in your logical subspace, yes. Okay? And then, the kind of questions that you can ask is, well, what is the gate time that is needed? This answers your question, but you have to do it in a self-consistent way. But you can go even further. You can say, well, how do we determine usually you're not interested in any specific gate, but let's say you want to implement a universal set of gates, so you need all single qubit gates and one entangling gate. And you don't necessarily know for a complex system what is the best entangling gate. So you can use concepts from quantum information, such as local equivalence classes, and formulate those as optimization functions. And I spare you, the functional becomes 8 lines of math. I didn't write it out, but if you're interested, that's what I refer to in these references down here. And then the algorithm automatically determines itself what specific gate is the best one. No objections. I called my talk Control of Open Quantum Systems.
I thought that the target is something that you want to determine.
Well, so of course, that's what I said. You have to decide what is the relevant physics. So for example, if I want a universal set of gates, the relevant physics is that I need one entangling gate, but I don't care which one. And then you can, what I'm telling you is you can find a way to encode this mathematically. And then you get the functional which has a slightly more complicated form than this. But you can do it. And the only condition that you have to fulfill is that you have to be able to take derivatives of this expression analytically in order to evaluate the gradient.
Okay. So there's always the desired gate we want to implement, and the U is kind of encodes to the epsilon and the time.
Exactly. So
it
far.
It does not kind of vary, let's say, the number of gates I'm allowed to use, the number of, let's say, you're fixing kind of. So the U kind of has in its evolution already what the system can offer you, not
yes.
Expanding the space of the power operations
exactly.
That you have.
Yes. And I'll say a bit more about controllability, which is the underlying problem under your question later. Okay, but the objection which I did expect now was that everything I told you so far uses the language of unitary evolution. And my talk is about open quantum systems, controlling open quantum systems, right? So this is obviously not enough if we want to look at open quantum systems, because we have to think about decoherence. So in general, we'll have the situation that we have some quantum system that we can control. And I think the safest way to distinguish between your environment and your system is by saying that the environment can be controlled at least to some extent. The system can be controlled to some extent, and the environment cannot. And then the two interact. And there are a number of open questions, like what are viable control strategies, and how far do they depend on the coupling between system and environment, or other properties of the environment? And what are fundamental limits to quantum control? And I would say that although we have some examples where we could answer them, in general, this is really an open field, and people have started to seriously look at this only within the last few years. And one more remark is important at this stage, because open quantum system does not only mean we have to deal with decoherence, but we should also keep in mind that certain control targets need dissipation. So if you want to optimize cooling, for example, then you know that cooling only works if you have dissipation, and then you, it can also be good for you. It's not necessarily an adversary.
Question. So even aside from the environment, I presume that there could be uncertainties in your knowledge of the systems Hamiltonian?
Yes.
And so, I mean, is there...
That's bad. So actually, and I'll also say a little bit more later, but there are examples where you can take the result of the optimal control calculation directly and go to the experiment and use it. And this has been done, for example, in Munich in the lab of Stefan Glaser. And he's working with NMR. So in their case, the Hamiltonian is extremely well known. And then it really works one-to-one. If you know your Hamiltonian less well, then it works less. You can accommodate fluctuations to some extent just by including them in your calculation. But if you know very little, then, I mean, you're trying to utilize interferences in your dynamics, very subtle effects. So, yeah, a certain knowledge of the system is necessary. Otherwise, it's not a viable approach.
We say qualitative, those are distinct from the environment. You know, sort of errors, uncertainty in the knowledge of the system should not be lumped.
Yes, you can. Of course, you can model it as noise. That's one way. Or you can model it as fluctuating parameters in your Hamiltonian. And both has already been done for a few examples. So, for example, I'm not mentioning it here, but in my group, we looked at this for Rydberg gates, where the Rydberg state typically may fluctuate a little bit, and then you can accommodate these fluctuations easily in your simulation and then find a gate that works, even though there you know that these fluctuations are present. Okay, so here's the program that I want to walk you through. I want to remind you of the difference of Markovian versus non-Markovian dynamics of an open system, and then say a little bit about controllability, so whether you can control at all or not, and then say how do we have to adapt the whole toolbox of optimal control in order to tackle open quantum systems, and then present you maybe all of these examples, maybe just two of them. Okay. So let's start with Markovian versus non-Markovian dynamics. So Markovian evolution means you have your system embedded in some environment, and the interaction with the environment leads to a fully irreversible loss of energy and phase. So whatever is gone, never comes back. And that's the essential difference to non-Markovian evolution. You still have an overall loss of energy and phase, but some backflow of information, of population, is possible. And there is a huge discussion in the literature that was sparked mainly by these two papers on how to characterize, how to measure these memory effects in your open system dynamics. And I'll say a little bit more about this later, but the main point for us here is that whatever the measure for non-Markovianity is, it tells you this should be good for control. For example, in this paper, they claim it's backflow of information. The measure that was proposed by Plenio and co-workers, it tells you bipartite correlations do not only decay, they can also increase again. So again, something that, that should be helpful for Cauchy. Now the problem is, it's not very easy to model non-Markovian evolution. So what is most often employed is really a Markovian bath model, and then you can write it in this generic form, your equation of motion. There exist non-Markovian variants that work always under specific assumptions. So for example, you can, in some cases, derive time-local non-Markovian master equations, where your decay rates in the Liouvillian become negative, time-dependent. You have stochastic approaches that work under certain assumptions. You can, what I'm calling the poor man's non-Markovian bath, use a single two-level fluctuator that is embedded in a Markovian bath to mimic non-Markovianity. Or you can use small size spin baths and then do the full evolution. And this is something which is interesting for us because we usually in control, we want to do things fast. And then what I'm arguing now is that for short times, these small size baths are okay. And even more, the approximation can be made rigorous in the mathematical sense. And the underlying reason is that the open system dynamics, if you start from a product state initially, is quasi-local. And the argument, I'm just sketching it very briefly. So here we have rewritten our Hamiltonian. This is the bath mode. This is the coupling between the system and the bath. And all that we are assuming is that you can write your couplings in terms of the operators, and you have a coupling matrix that characterizes the strength and the topology of the couplings. And now what we do is we represent this Hamiltonian on a graph. And this representation on a graph allows us to reorder the bath modes such that we know which bath modes are most important for the system and which ones are less important. Because we can use the graph distance to achieve that. So we can rewrite this Hamiltonian in this form where we have all the modes at distance d and then the coupling between those modes to the next modes. And so far we haven't done anything, so the sum here can run to infinity, which of course we cannot do numerically, but now we can truncate this sum and replace it by this truncated Hamiltonian. And now I can ask the question, if you're looking at observables that you obtain with this Hamiltonian and with that Hamiltonian, what is the error that you're making? And the answer is you get a Lieb-Robinson bound. So you get a speed with which the correlations spread, and this speed is determined essentially by the structure of your coupling matrix. So what this means is, okay, given a certain time t and a certain error that you allow yourself to make, then you know how large you have to choose this n in order to for this still to become correct. And if you think of a small size spin bath, that's, I think, intuitively not so very surprising because you just order your spins according to their coupling strength. You have a discrete bath already from the very beginning. So here's your system, and then you have these layers of less and less important modes. What was slightly more surprising is that this reordering also works for continuous environments. So if you think of the standard bosonic bath of harmonic oscillators, and the only condition that we need there is that you have a finite support on which the couplings are non-zero. And that is, I think, a very physical requirement. That at some time you have a frequency cut. And then what you have to do, but if you wanted to simulate infinite time, you would have to resolve this support completely. But as soon as you're interested in shorter times, you can sample this support with a certain number of modes, and depending on this time, you will need more or less. And again, you can estimate a priori, before doing the calculation, what is the number of modes that you need that guarantees you're not making any error larger than what you want. So this means we can also look at non-Markovian dynamics. We have a tool to do this. Now, the next important conceptual question is, well, is there any hope that we can control things at all? And that comes to the question of how many of these operators do you need here? So let's first look at closed systems, and let's assume that we have sufficient resources. So this can become very strong, for example. And then we can ask, well, what do we need so that we can reach any state given that we have to solve this dynamics? And what you can show is that if H0 has a finite spectrum and you look at state-to-state transitions and you have sufficiently many of these couplings, the evolution is completely controllable. And this may look not so great because you have this condition here on a finite spectrum. Well, actually, you can generalize it even to infinitely dimensional Hamiltonians using Galerkin-type ideas that you truncate, that you're able to truncate at a certain moment. And if this is too mathematical, I mean, an intuitive example is an ion trap, which has infinitely many states. But now you can choose an external control that separates your total Hilbert space into a finite one and an infinite one. And then within the finite subspace, you still have retained controllability.
So how do you have completely control? You can get overlap of one?
You can get from any state to any other state with accuracy as you want. Okay, so now the next question is, well, how many of these couplings do I need, or of these operators? So just for simplicity, let's assume we have a single term here, and let's assume that this doesn't depend on time. Because then I can write my formal solution to the Schrödinger equation in this way, that I write the exponential in terms of iterated commutators. So what are these iterated commutators? Well, they are the directions in your state space in which the evolution can proceed. So if you want to be able to go anywhere in Hilbert space, it means you have to be able to generate with these nested commutators any direction. Okay, and a single term here may be enough, depending on your system and your drift. Okay, so this expression that I wrote down here, very simple, still depends on your initial state. That's, you want a general statement. And this is easy to achieve because now you can look at the Schrödinger equation for your time evolution operator. And then pre-write it in this form that you still have these generators of the dynamics, these matrices Ci. And this expression tells you that you can get any unitary operation provided you have all possible generators of the dynamics in a finite Hilbert space. Or in other words, your Lie algebra, and that's what is formed by these generators, has a full ring. Okay, so for closed systems, the question of controllability is solved. So you have to check whether your system fulfills this full rank condition, and if so, you can do whatever you want. Now, if you want to have a more intuitive picture of controllability, there is a one-to-one connection to connectivity. So if you choose a basis and you write now down all transition matrix elements, what this requirement of controllability means is you have to be able to connect all states, not directly, but by some way to any other state. And that already tells you that if you have a symmetry, then your Hilbert space decomposes into subspaces, which are not coupled, and then you don't have full controllability. Okay, so it's, I think, intuitively very nice to understand. Again, this is the story for closed quantum systems. And now what I'm saying about open quantum systems is very little, because it's essentially an open problem.
Can I ask a question about the symmetry thing? So can't I just always choose epsilon L's to violate whatever symmetries I have? I mean, the symmetries are symmetries of H0, I presume?
No, symmetries are symmetries of the whole Hamiltonian.
Yes.
So if you have a symmetry, I mean, if you have an operator here that you can drive a certain evolution,
sure.
Because, I mean, what you do is you generate these commutators of the drift with the coupling operators. Okay. So for Markovian dynamics, the situation is not as bad. What you have to do, but this already you do when you assume the Markovian approximation, is that the control doesn't change your dissipation. And then there are two special cases. One is that your dissipation essentially acts as a scalar, and then if your closed loop evolution on the Bloch sphere would be this red line, this orbit, then what the dissipation does is it works as a contraction of this orbit. And then you can reach any state within this wedge. And for infinite time, the only states that you can reach are fixed points of your Liouville wedge. Again, I think intuitively not so surprising. the more generic case means that the dissipators do not necessarily commute with the Hamiltonian. And that means that you can generate new directions of evolution by this interplay of coherent and incoherent parts of your dynamics. So then, as is sketched here, your state space becomes larger than just a contraction. And you can translate this Lie algebra formalism also to the open quantum system language, and that's what has been done in this report, for example. Now, for non-Markovian dynamics, which I told you from the control perspective is much more interesting, there are no rigorous results at all. So it's an open question. Which means we just have to go and try and see. It's not so. We are not guaranteed to have success. But even before setting out to do that, we have to first say, okay, now how do we measure success of control? So what I showed you before was this slide. But I said for a certain state.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So what you said is an open problem. Right? You mentioned something about symmetry, etc. These ideas cannot carry over to quantum to open systems because you can also talk about the symmetries of the super operators, etc.
This is exactly what has been done for Markovian systems. So there in this case there are rigorous results that you can find here. There's more literature that mainly goes back to Al-Kafini. And you can find essentially all of the references in this review. But for non-Markovian dynamics, nobody has really looked seriously at this problem. And I think it requires a new language, because you somehow have to introduce time into the controllability analysis, and that's what hasn't been done yet. That's a whole subject of its own. Okay, so. This is the slide you've seen before in my introduction, where I said, okay, my goal is this overlap of the actually propagated state with my target, or of my desired evolution and my actual evolution. So in this case, it's straightforward. If now I want to go from coherent evolution to an open quantum system, it's easy to see what I have to do. I have here the scalar product between two states. This I can also formulate for an open quantum system. So I replace the scalar product by the Hilbert-Schmidt product of density operators. So I have my time-evolved initial state, and I match it with my target state. And I do the same thing. I treat this as a function of the field, evaluate these extrema conditions, and I get a similar set of equations that now I have to solve for the density operator. Okay.
So to be clear, let me see if I understand it correctly. Can the target state be some molecule that you want to synthesize, and the initial state will be some solution?
You can, but in this case, you can convince yourself even before doing the optimization that you will never be able to do this with 100% success.
Mm-hmm. So fine, I'm happy to take less, but I want to find the optimal process. It's not 100%. The optimal process.
Yes, so the tricky point in that. And
so maybe you'll give another example.
Well, the tricky point when you do want to do synthesis is that you're starting out of a continuum of states, and you have to be careful to properly model this continuum.
So maybe you give one example of the process that you want, of a target state.
So what I'm citing here is examples of cooling. So let's say you're starting from some initial state and you want to reach a coherent state and you need dissipation there. Okay. Now, earlier in the introduction, we looked at this expression if we wanted to get a specific quantum gate. And now the question is, how do we translate this into the language of Liouville space from Hilbert? And the simple answer would be, well, again, we just lift it. You can do that. Then you get here, again, a Hilbert-Schmidt product of your actual evolution, but you have to expand this now in Liouville space, and you match it with your desired evolution. Okay. The problem is that you have here this d squared, where d is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So this quickly becomes really large. And the question is, do you really need this? And the next point is that if you have more how to say, more sophisticated control targets, like you want to optimize for a certain local equivalence class or an arbitrary perfect entangler, then you have to calculate the local, so-called local invariants, which depend to a function of u. And then what you have to do is somehow you have to extract from your open system evolution, your dynamical map, what is the coherent part of it. Okay. And the question is, how do you do that?
So do you have to control dissipation as well? I think you can only control the Hamiltonians. It's impossible to realize that control.
That's exactly the point of the controllability analysis. So by definition, we only control the Hamiltonian. We don't control the environment. Okay. And you're completely correct. You can, in case of an open quantum system, you cannot reach arbitrary targets. The question is, what can you reach? And what does it depend on? Okay, so we came up with two propositions to address these questions. First, the question is, okay, you're given some time evolution, rho of capital T. How many of these rho do I need to optimize a gate? Do I really need d squared? And our answer is no, you actually only need three. If your target is a unitary and not a general open system evolution. And if you want to extract the u from your open system evolution, you can do this analytically. If you choose, specifically choose certain OJ, and you need 2d minus one of them. Again, it's an analytical construction. And we use the concept of commutant space and total rotation. So this, we came up with those ourselves. Other people use different terms, and you'll see in a minute what I mean. So we find a minimal set of states. And what is the intuition behind it? So let's again assume for a moment that the time evolution is coherent. Okay. Then we can write our rho of t in this form. And then we know immediately that we need more than one state to determine u, because certain states will have a common eigenbasis with this u. Okay. So we need two. And how do we choose the first one? We choose the first one such that it fixes the basis completely. And we can do this by defining a complete set of one-dimensional projectors, Pi, and we construct our state in this way that these lambdas here, the weights, are non-degenerate. And then this state allows us to look into each direction of the basis with this specific lambda, so we need only a single state. And then we have a second state, and this we construct such that it has no common eigenspace with any of these basis fixing projectors. So this is what we call total rotation. And if you know about mutually unbiased spaces, so a mutually unbiased in a mutually unbiased basis, you have d states that are totally rotated with respect to your first basis. We only take one. Okay, but it's the same idea. And now these two states are sufficient to distinguish any u from any other u, provided your time evolution is coherent. And then, if you now go to open system evolution, all that we need is only yet another state, a third state, to check whether evolution is unitary or not. So we can actually write down an optimization functional with only three states, where here's examples that do the job for these three states. So this is one possibility to fix the basis, to fulfill this condition on the projectors. Then this would be the totally rotated state with respect to that one. And we need the third state to check unitality on the logical subspace. And then you can show, you can prove that the evolution is unitary on the logical subspace, and you implement really that gate if and only if this J of t attains its minimum. So actually, we need to propagate much less than we thought. And of course, these concepts for characterization are relevant not only in the context of optimal control, but also of quantum process topology. And that's what we did in this paper here. Okay, but here we focus on control. So now I'll have a little bit of time left to tell you something about examples. So I'll try to illustrate different control strategies, and let's start with fighting decoherence. So the simplest way of fighting decoherence is to be fast. And the example that we looked at is superconducting qubits, and we chose transmons because they have comparatively long decoherence times, which tells us that if we realize gate times below a certain threshold, let's say 200 or 250 nanoseconds, then we will be able to beat decoherence. Now, what is the problem with transmons? So usually, people treat those in the dispersive regime, and then you get an effect that you can integrate out the cavity with which both qubits interact, and you get an ineffective qubit-qubit Hamiltonian. The catch is that in this regime, the qubit-qubit interaction is actually too weak to get really fast gates. So what we did instead is we said, okay, anyway, we're doing numerics, so let's look at the full complexity. And here's the Hamiltonian for two transmons. So here we have two unharmonic ladders, which may be coupled directly to each other. But more importantly, they're each coupled to a cavity, and we can drive this cavity. Okay? And let's optimize this, and we are able to get fast gate. So here's one example for a controlled phase gate, 200 nanoseconds. We could even do the optimization in this case for the coherent case, and then if we add the dissipation, it reduces by not so much. What is more interesting on this slide is that this is the spectrum of the optimized field. And what is shown by these little arrows here is the frequencies that you would expect, where you drive resonantly the qubits and the cavity. And you see that you get a much more complex spectrum. And now you can check what are the additional transitions that you are driving. And you will find, for example, that you drive higher qubit transitions. So the logical levels are 0 and 1. But your qubit, we took up to 5 or 6 of those levels in the unharmonic ladder into account. So this, you can exploit this larger dimension of your state space. And you can also have kind of funny transitions where your cavity goes from 0 to 2 simultaneously with the qubit being de-excited. So the short message from this slide is that you can, with optimal control, you can really exploit this complexity of the Hamiltonian and get fast gates. So you can say, fine. But now tell me which gate, what is the shortest possible duration, and how do I actually choose my system parameters? And for two transmons, you can still answer these questions really comprehensively. So what we did is we looked at this, let's say, from a top perspective, and first asked ourselves, well, what are the relevant system parameters? So here's the Hamiltonian again, and I now highlighted the parameters that you fix when you design your transmons. They are static parameters. And you see that you have 5. Well, first, this J doesn't really help you a lot. You may as well set it to 0. And then you have 4 parameters left. And you can reduce them to 5, actually. But you can reduce them to 2 because you have one parameter that tells you how strong is your coupling. And that is the departure. You can measure the departure from the dispersive regime by looking at the ratio of the detuning from the cavity, detuning of the qubits from the cavity, over the qubit-cavity coupling. So if this is small, then you're not in the dispersive regime. And if you look at the literature, there are gates which are realized by utilizing the unharmonicity of the qubit. So you have...
So this is, of course, not the full evolution of the system. This is the Hamiltonian part. And then we have the Liouvillian,
yes.
The lambda. Okay. So this... we are solving the whole problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this EFT, there are some conditions on it. Because, for example, the cavity cannot be driven faster than its bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all included?
This is included, yes.
Because you're looking at the whole of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So actually, there's one catch, if you want me to be really honest, is that we may not, I mean, at some point this approximation actually breaks down and we should take the real potential of this, which could be done, but we haven't done it yet. But that's, I would say, it's not a basic problem, just that at some point we'll have to do it. And the second important parameter is this ratio of the qubit-qubit detuning over the unharmonicity. And to see why this is important, you realize if you look in the literature that there are resonances that you get when the qubit-qubit detuning matches the anharmonic deal, so transitions with higher levels in your anharmonic ladder. And now this system interacts, the two transmons interact already with each other because they are both coupled to this cavity. So let's first set this driving to zero and just look at the field tree evolution. And what gates do we want? We want a universal set. So here, I show you the field tree evolution, and what we plot here is an effective entanglement creation parameter that you get by comparing the energy shift due to the interaction. So whenever this is large, you get entanglement. And then we can do the same thing by saying, okay, well, how long does it take for the field tree evolution if I start from a product state to get a concurrence of one? So depending on where in this parameter space with these two parameters you are, this can take something between 10 to 10 nanoseconds to 1 microsecond or so. Okay. And of course, we have a decay. And if I'm dressing my qubits with a cavity, this decay may actually be enhanced. Now, the good news from this slide is that whereas these times for getting entanglement vary over two orders of magnitude, this enhancement of the decay just varies by a factor of two. So there's no reason, really, to stay away from these near-resonant areas of parameter space. And the numbers on this plot here, these are all the published gates in the literature. And you see most of them are in the dispersive regime, and there's only one that is in this near-resonant part. And most of the interesting part of parameter space has not yet been explored. So let's still look at the field-free evolution and now look at in which regions of parameter space can we get a concurrence of one, depending on the duration. So I varied the duration. Now I'm setting the duration to 250 or 10 nanoseconds. And whenever I have light here, then I mean I can get a concurrence of one. Okay, so as I make the duration shorter, this region in parameter space becomes smaller, as I would expect. Now I'm adding control, and I can maximize entanglement, so I can maximize coherence. So you see, compared to the previous case, which was shown up here, this region can be enlarged because you're driving the cavity, so you're making the effective interaction stronger, and you can get entanglement in larger regions of parameter space. But to get the universal set of gates, you do not only need to create entanglement, you need also to be able to destroy it. So that's what is shown here in the middle, where we minimize the entanglement. And you see, so here the dark regions are good. You see that also there is quite a range in parameter space that you can use. And in the end, what you want is really both. So we look at the product of the ability to create entanglement and to disentangle. And you see that, okay, for long gates, 200 nanoseconds, there's a huge area in parameter space. But even for very short times, such as 10 nanoseconds, you still have a significant area to play around, which has not been explored so far. So we looked specifically at these two points, A and B, and found that in what is the shortest possible duration of a universal set of gates in this area, and we find that for entangling gates, if we use optimization for an arbitrary perfect entangler, we get that the minimum gate duration is 10 nanoseconds. And with the same parameters, we need 50 nanoseconds to get to get all the necessary single qubit gates for a universal set of gates.
And so you could also ask a different question, like what is the optimal time to get a certain fidelity? Like, because like if you make the gate time too long, then the decoherence kicks in, right? So there's probably like a best time if you just want to get
Well, this is exactly what is shown on this plot, because this is the error that I get, the gate error. And the gray line is the gate error that I get due to dissipation. So I always have the background decay that limits me. So of course, if my gate takes too long, then this will be the limiting factor.
Ah, so exactly where this minimum is the optimal.
And exactly where this minimum is tells you this is the what we call the quantum speed limit.
And so this is defined by what now? By having a set of universal gates?
Yes.
With minimal time?
Yes, exactly. Well, we vary the time and then we check what is the error that we get.
But the quantum speed limit point, that's what you call the quantum speed limit.
Yeah, so this point here, that's what we call the quantum speed limit. So if you only look at entanglement, you would get this answer, but if you really want the universal set of gates, we have to take both of them, and then that answer. Okay, so this is one example that is very typical for optimal control, that we can use it to determine this quantum speed limit, and then if we're lucky, like in the case of the trans ones, we are fast enough to beat the coherence. Since I promised you sort of an overview, I'm listing here also other literature, and I think you can look it up when the slides are up. So there are other control strategies to beat decoherence. For example, you can try to go through regions of state space that are less affected by decoherence. Or you can try to decouple the system from its environment. That's what's known as dynamical decoupling. Or you can use symmetry protection, which are decoherence-free subspaces. But this is what I would say what is known, and I think I'm skipping over that part.
Can I ask about the status of experiments? So people are great at building transmons and manipulating them these days. Have they actually tried to implement some of these protocols?
So actually the transmon community is one of those that are very open, and especially the IBM group is using optimal control to get faster gates. And so I think two of the points that I had listed by these numbers on the plot were actually using optimal control. But the point is, I mean, and at that stage you're limited by the system parameters that you have chosen. Because there is a fundamental limit on how fast you can entangle and disentangle. And optimal control cannot give you something shorter. It can just give you something with high accuracy at that time.
So for open system control, do you think the feedback channel is better?
It depends on what you want to do. So I would say if you for gates, no. For cooling, it may be the better strategy. But I'm skipping over the cooling part now in view of time, and I want to tell you this one other example where I want to show you how you can actually exploit the environment for control, even though it's not controllable itself. Okay. To this end, I want to come back to the point, what does non-Markovian evolution mean? And I told you there is this big discussion in the literature on how to characterize non-Markovianity. And from my point of view, I mean, there are measures which are very strict and measures which are less strict. It doesn't really matter, because what it means in any case is that here, for example, you recover previously lost information, or you have a re-increase of correlations in a bipartite system, or you have a re-increase of the accessible volume in state space. So any of this is good for control. And just to illustrate the last, because this is actually the only measure that you can evaluate numerically, and that's why we are using it. So if you start from a Bloch ball and you have Markovian evolution, your volume shrinks until it becomes a point. But if you have non-Markovian evolution, it may shrink and then re-expand, shrink, re-expand, and so on. So now you will be able to do something that requires this state space and not just a point. And you're again looking at superconducting qubits. Now a phase qubit, so n-level system. And this is inspired by an experiment in Israel that in the group of Nadav Katz, who was, before he moved back, was a postdoc here in the Martinez group. So we have again one unharmonic ladder. And we can drive it with a biased current. The low frequency doesn't do anything, low frequency steering, in terms of generating new directions of evolution. And with the high frequency, you can generate all SO4 operations. So in case of four levels, you actually know the solution analytically. And this is what is called Pythagorean control. It's essentially a generalization of Rabi cycling to four levels. It's quite elegant. But you can do this also for SON, then you have to do it numerically. Now, if you want to implement an arbitrary unitary evolution with this Hamiltonian, you would want SU4 and not, or SUN and not SON. So you can ask, well, what are the operations which are missing that you might need to use control for to get them? In order to see that, we can use the Cartan decomposition of the Lie algebra. And then we see that we can write any element of the group SUN as a product of K1, A, K2, where these K1 and K2 are elements of SON. And A is a diagonal unitary matrix. And so this diagonal unitary matrices, these are the matrices with the non-local phases, and I write you non-local in quotation marks because it's a one-partite system, so it's not really two qubits. But you can think of it. If you think of four levels as being a two-qubit system, these would be non. Okay, so these A's is what we need. And what is nice about these phase qubits is that you understand the decoherence very well. So it's a Josephson junction, and the main source of decoherence are charge defects, which you can model as two-level systems. So they're like a natural spin back. So you have splitting of these two-level systems and a coupling to our actual phase qubit power system. And now you can think, well, what do these two-level systems do to your main system? Well, if the splitting of the defect is much larger than your base frequency, there's no effect. If it's much smaller, then you get pure defacing. If it's more or less on the same order, and the coupling here is weak, then you get relaxation. And if the coupling is strong, you'll get non-Markovian dynamics. Okay. What is even nicer is that in this case, these parameters have been measured, so the bath, in a way, has been fully characterized in these experiments in Israel. So we know how to model them, and we can now come up with a model for this non-Markovian evolution by partitioning our environment. So we have our system, the qubit, and then we have a primary environment in which we put all the strongly coupled two-level systems, and then we have a weakly coupled secondary environment which contains all the other two-level systems, which we treat by the standard Markovian approximation. Okay, so here's our total evolution in the qubit and primary bath subspace. We have this Hamiltonian with the parameters that are known, and then we have Lindblad dissipators in the usual form. And for simplicity, we only assume T1 not to have two, but it could also be T2. And now what we want is we want to optimize for diagonal gates with non-local phases. For example, let's take this one. And we start with a single primary bath two-level system. So let's assume there's no secondary bath. Then this is what we would get. So we have here the coupling strength between the system and this single primary bath mode, and here the gate duration. So you see, if the coupling is very weak, then your error is very large. But as your coupling becomes stronger and your duration becomes larger, you can get this region here where you make no error at all. That's, of course, not the full truth, because you still have the secondary bath. But if you now include this secondary bath, nothing really changes qualitatively. Just that the overall minimum error that you're making is now set by the T1 time that we have put in. And it tells you that there is a certain region in this space where you can get high fidelity gates that you cannot get with only the Hamiltonian evolution alone. Because you have this primary. So you get a small error even if your fluctuator, your dielectric defect is lost. But if your coupling is too weak, then there's no control. So what is the role of the non-Markovianity? So again, we are confining ourselves first to a single two-level system, and now I'm plotting here the T1 on the system and the T1 on my fluctuator. And if the loss is not too strong, so up in this triangle, again, your error becomes very small. Okay. So you can ask yourself, well, when do you lose this control that you get only by, you know, cycling populations through the bath and back? Well, if the coupling becomes too weak, or in other words, if the decay is stronger than the timescale of the coupling, then you don't have this type of control. So you could say, well, this is a poor man's or poor woman's bath, just to have a single fluctuator. But actually, now we can add additional fluctuators. up to, I think we looked at up to 4, but then it's, we run out of fun with setting all these parameters, and you don't need to read this table. I mean, the only important point is that look at the errors here that you get, and they're all of the same order of magnitude, except for this one case where you have a strongly coupled, very lossy system close by to the first one. So then this doesn't work. But other than that, adding these additional fluctuators doesn't change the picture at all. So you can add more and more, and it doesn't make your life more difficult. So you can ask, well, what does the control actually do? So first of all, here is the time dependence of the drive. So it looks pretty benign, I would say. And this is our measure of non-Markovianity. So you see that we have really, at the beginning, at the end, we have non-Markovian evolution. And how does it work? Well, what we do is we want to align the phases in these four levels. So we plot here the evolution of the three excited states of our qubit. And you see that, for one, we really acquire the non-local phase. We go from here over there. And for two, we go back to the original place. And we do this with a lot of oscillations and state space. And the point is, this is why we need optimal control, because this would be hard to design by hand. Okay? Because in the end, you have to align all the phases properly. Okay, so let me wrap up. And these are like the three take-home messages from this talk. A good strategy in the detrimental case of an open quantum system is if you have unwanted Markovian dynamics, try to do things as fast as you can. And optimal control theory is a very nice tool for that, that this has been developed over the last few years and is quite at the mature stage now. And this is the case I skipped about. It's essentially the case of cooling, that in this case you need dissipation, and even Markovian dynamics is desired, but your target state must be a fixed set of your Liouvillean, otherwise you can't drive into it. And you can, what control tells you is that you can generalize this idea to more general settings, and then it's equivalent to quantum reservoir engineering. And that is actually the main reason why I came to this program. I was hoping to meet more people who are interested in quantum reservoir engineering. So if anybody does that, please talk to me. And the last example I showed you just now is that of non-Markovian dynamics, where you have both beneficial and detrimental effects. And you get beneficial effects if you have a few strongly coupled and sufficiently isolated modes in your environment that you can address. And what is nice is that this is really applicable in current experiments with superconducting qubits. And I would say whenever you have a natural small spin bath, you can use this type of ideas. And one open question in this field, which has many, as I told you, is can you exploit other features of non-Markovianity for control? I want to acknowledge the people who actually did the work. So Julia Gwaldi was a postdoc in my group who did this dynamical renormalization of the system bath that tells you how large your system has to be. And these two graduate students did all of the rest of the work that I told you about. Michael Goertz is now in Stanford, and Daniel Reich is in Aarhus. And these are our funding agencies. Thanks for your attention.
So is there a way in the optimization itself to build in something like robustness? I mean, what you show, because that's a process that you don't want strongly fluctuating.
Yeah, I should have known that.
Zero fidelity, one. And you showed, I mean, basically the approach you showed is, okay, let's just calculate four parameters, let's see this map, and try to find spaces where it's kind of robust. But is there a way actually in the optimization itself to
Yeah, so the best way is, I mean, you mean fluctuations in your control?
Well, not in the result. We should go back to your working way, for example, in the transmon, I think, example. You could see for longer time scales, it pretty much looks like a spider web.
In the transmon case. I'm not sure the dynamics, actually.
This 2D was a 2D color, this one. Yeah, exactly. If you look at the top, for example, that's kind of this spider web is not so good, right? It's a fluctuating spot.
But this is the field-free case.
And
this
nevertheless,
is the case
nevertheless anything which has such a structure does not have enough free or something. It just needs this sense. That's of course something that's experimentally not so desired because it means you change a little bit parameters and suddenly you go from very good fidelity to very poor fidelity.
So here, we didn't include this in the calculation, but you can. So, I think as soon as you're talking to a specific, about a specific experiment.
And what's the idea of encoding it? How do you encode it?
The same order what I mentioned before, that you just say, okay, my parameters are fluctuating within a certain range, and I optimize for an ensemble of Hamiltonians with these that samples these fluctuations. And I'm looking for the control that works as the best compromise for all of them. And we have done this for the Rydberg gate. But in this case, I mean, this is a more, first we asked a more general question here.
I have a general question. What's the complexity of the optimization for a not a many-body system, for a few quantum system?
Complexity is...
How complex does it get, this optimization? And is it... Do we require a quantum computer to optimize actually quantum computer?
Well, if you want to go to large systems, so it's an interesting question because there is the aspect of what is the numerical effort that you need. And then the other question is how many degrees of freedom do you need in your control? Like, for example, how many frequency components do you need in your control to realize a certain target?
Well, my question was more specific. Is it known? Is it like, have people classified these things?
Yeah, so there is one paper by Simona Montangelo and Seth Lloyd. I think it was published in PRL last year or early this year that looked at this question.
Okay. Question? So it's come back to this robustness. Is taking into account like errors in the control field is like the same thing as it's just like having errors in like the initial parameters and then searching for like
it is because you always have this product of the control with your coupling operator. So whether you let your coupling operator fluctuate or you let your control fluctuate, it's in the dynamics it's the same.
Okay, so I think we should thank Christian again.